I've talked to so many people there, and one of their aspirations, dreams, is just to go to Masjid al-Aqsa. It was very inspiring to hear that because, you know, from America, we have every right to go, and it's pretty easy for us to go. But for them, it's like this impossible idea that they dream of. Another really interesting thing I wanted to point out is the diversity in Gaza and Palestine, but Gaza specifically I'll talk about. Well, I don't know what you think of when you think of a Gazan in terms of what they look like, what's their skin color, but it's really diverse. I was really shocked. I met a black family in Gaza, but they're Gazan. And I asked them, I was like, where are you from? And they said, we're from Palestine. And I was like, well, like, where are your grandparents from? We're from Palestine. I just didn't get it, you know? It was a learning opportunity for me that Palestine is a very historic, diverse country.
Yep.
And Brother Hassan is Palestinian, yeah, so he can talk about that. But I was truly shocked at how diverse the people of Gaza were.
I mean, the people of Gaza in themselves, they are largely a refugee population. You know, in 1948, when the Nakba happened, or the catastrophe in Arabic, and the people were driven out of their lands, Yaffa, or now in English, Jaffa, Haifa, Akka, all of these lands that were ethnically cleansed, a lot of them not just went to the West Bank, but a lot of them went to Gaza as well. Really, that's, you'll have people from all over in this small strip of land. And people of all different diversities, all different kinds of backgrounds, but they all share a common, I want to say, a common pain. And the pain is only getting worse. And since we've come back, it's only been a couple of weeks, things have exponentially gotten worse.
So I'll talk about this IPC category. It's like the worldwide famine category that the UN uses. We are in stage 5 right now, phase 5, which is famine. And what that means is that the death rate is going to go up exponentially. If you give a starving person in phase five, if you give them food, you're almost killing them by giving them food, because there's a thing called refeeding syndrome, where you can't just give them food. You got to feed them in an appropriate manner, fix the electrolyte imbalances, fix the phosphorus imbalances. It's dangerous. And so we're at a stage where if we're not feeding these people, they're going to die. But even if we feed them improperly, they're at risk for death. No, we're not. We're talking about advanced diets with... I see some people nodding their heads, so maybe they know more than me.
So, I mean, you would need to make sure that they have certain salts in their blood, like phosphorus, for example. If you give food to a severely starved person, the mechanisms in their body will try to digest that food. And they will excrete things like insulin. You know, I'm getting very pathophysiologic here. Insulin will make the amounts of salt in your blood go haywire. And so if your phosphorus levels, for example, which insulin plays a strong part in, if they go extremely low, then you're at risk of having heart electricity problems, of sudden death from those kinds of issues. And so it's not that easy. It's not just, oh, this is a starving person, give them food, they'll be okay. This is what Dr. Aziz is referring to. This is refeeding syndrome.
So if you look at the bottom right, death rate, anywhere from 2 to 10,000. I'm scared we're going to come to a point where we're not going to see 10 starvation deaths a day.
Yeah, I want to throw a crazy statistic that I heard yesterday on the news. One-third of the number of starving people who had died since the beginning of the onslaught have died in the last 3 days. So, in the last 2 years, there have been, for example, 90, it was 90 deaths due to starvation. 30 deaths have been due to starvation in the last 3 days alone. And so when you have that number in the last 3 days, you can see how much of an exponential rise it has been. And unfortunately, it will only continue to get worse since aid is being blocked. There is no food.
So this is what he's talking about. If you look at where my mouse is, one death, which is a child, back in February, one death in March, one death in April, one death in May,
five deaths of children and one death of an adult in June. July, since it's been about 4 months, the human body can only stand this for so long. You see what the occupation was planning. This is not a month plan. This is a six-month plan, and just annihilate everyone through starvation. This next number is not going to go down. It's going to skyrocket.
And I don't want to be political, obviously, but these are real numbers. This is from the Ministry of Health. The way that our Western media pushes or prefaces the idea of the Ministry of Health as being run by untrustworthy sources, this is completely whitewashing the numbers and rewriting the facts and giving you a bias even before you hear them. The numbers are true. There are doctors, there are statisticians there that are working on bringing these numbers to the public eye.
So this is explaining the markets right now. I'm going to have Hassan talk to you about this.
So this is in Arabic. I'll just translate. So this is a chart of the essentials, a kind of essential food items before and after the war. And, you know, I'm not going to get into the absolute numbers, but I want to get into the percentage rises. So, for example, flour. Flour has gone up not 1%, not 5%, 2,900%. The price of flour has gone up 2,900%. A kilo of flour, 2.2 pounds of flour, is $50 to $60 US dollars. That's how much a kilo. Sugar, the one right next to it on the utmost left, has got up 11,600%. It has gone up 11,600%. Sugar is a luxurious commodity. It is not something that you're going to come across every single day. Regular cooking oil has gone up about 380%. Rice has gone up 500%. Tomatoes, exponential numbers. You can see tomatoes, potatoes, onions. I haven't seen a single onion in my entire time there. Garlic, no one's seen garlic in months. Common everyday garlic that you use in food every single day, no one has seen garlic in months over there.
You can talk. All right, so this is this was the major academic hospital in all of Gaza, which was world renowned, actually. These guys had a system of education, medical system was phenomenal before this genocide. This is all Shifa Hospital. These are before and after pictures. You can just see how they absolutely devastated this beautiful hospital. We still have medical delegations going there. I would consider them the brave doctors who actually want to get out of the south and go to the north, where it's absolute annihilation and it's way more unsafe than even being in the south. And it's just crazy to see how far we have gotten from Al-Shifa Hospital initially being bombed early on in this genocide to where we are now, where 94% of all hospitals have been damaged or destroyed.
And, you know, I'm glad that we live in this era. Unfortunately, you know, we're still living in eras of death and destruction. But this isn't World War II, where there was no social media. You can look this stuff up online. You can go to Google Earth. You can see the differences, how it was back then and how it is now. This is open to the public to see. So, you know, Palestine, and this whole idea of Palestine and this whole this issue that has been going on since 1948 and even before, when it was the British Mandate of Palestine and the colonialism and settling of Palestine even before, this is the root cause of all of this problem. It is the idea that Palestinians are not treated as dignified human beings. It is the idea that Palestinians are not even second-class citizens. As the testimony of many Israeli ministers, they are subhuman, likened to animals. And it is the right of the Palestinians to have their own land. It is the right of the Palestinians to be recognized as having a state. And that is the case. 75% of the world recognizes the state of Palestine. Today, maybe a little too late, but France said that they would recognize Palestine. Canada said that they would recognize Palestine. And this is essentially the cause that the Palestinians are fighting for.
The positive thing is the world will eventually wake up and there will be a Palestine, a free Palestine. There will be. It's just how much pain do the Gazans, the Palestinians, truly have to go through to get to that point. They've been fighting so long with their lives, and they're going to continue. They're not going to give up. This is just another representation, not a representation, an actual picture of the beautiful beach of Gaza before the genocide and after. It has been littered with, that's one-third of all of Gaza living in these tents.
These are the tents of Mawasi Khan Yunis that we were talking to you guys about, that refugee camp.
This is the reality as we're driving through. That's what we were seeing. This is more in North Gaza, where it's essentially flattened in Rafah, which is essentially flattened.
So we shouldn't forget also that the doctors working in Gaza are Gazans themselves. So they share the plight of all Gazans. These Gazan doctors that come to work every single day for the last 2 years, they are Gazans as well. They don't have food. They live in tents. They are weak. These people are treating the patients. So it's truly the weak treating the weak. They are fainting. They are skin and bones. The attending I was working with had lost 30 kilos since the beginning of the war, which is about 65, 70 pounds. And you know, more to say about doctors. They are truly our inspiration, and they are truly role models to any healthcare worker, and not even healthcare workers, to all humans all around the world. These are the front line. These are the front runners. They have put everything. They have put everything in their lives to save humanity. They are embodying the Quranic verse of فَمَنْ أَحْيَاهَا فَمَنْ أَحْيَاهَا كَأَنَّ حَيَّ النَّاسَ جَمِيعًا. Whoever saves one life is as if they saved the entirety of humanity. And by doing so, they are putting a target on themselves. There are many doctors who have already been martyrs. There are doctors who we currently don't even know what's happening to them. Our biggest inspiration, Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya.
I want everyone to know this name at the end of this lecture. I want everyone to look at his beautiful face on the bottom right. This is probably the most iconic picture of our generation, in my opinion, where the last man standing in his hospital refused to give up. And the IOF is too scared to even come out of their tanks, so they tell this doctor in a white coat, you come to us. There's two tanks in the distance, as you can see there. And this is the last time humanity has ever seen him. And his lawyer just gave us an update a week ago, I think this week, that he's in terrible condition. He has no charges against him. And he's been in detention for, what, 380 days or something? And this is one of the most beautiful human beings in our existence, of our day and age. If you listen to him, you could see how much he cares for his patients. And you know, I actually was really inspired by him. When we were told Nasser Hospital might be invaded when we were there, they just told us, make sure you follow their instructions. And I was like, would I really want to leave these nurses and doctors that I just met behind and let them to their fate and maybe put in a, you know, under the sand and asphyxiate? Or am I going to be like a Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya, where I'm going to stick with them? And alhamdulillah, that opportunity, or that test never came, you know? And I thank Allah for that, because that would have been a very difficult test. But we should all strive to be like this man.
You know, there's a saying in Arabic. I'll translate it into English. If you are more afraid of your life than you are of the enemy, then you do not know what courage is. And Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya, standing in front of those tanks, obviously did not fear for his life as much as the enemy. This is the embodiment of courage, and this picture right here reminds us of what happened in 2005, if you remember the child holding the stone and standing in front of the tank, Faris Oud. Now, unfortunately, he's not the only one. We have seen a lot of doctors and healthcare professionals being targeted by the IOF and being martyred. Dr. Marwan Sultan, just recently, a cardiovascular physician in an Indonesian hospital, was martyred, along with his entire family. These are beautiful people, beautiful families, all smiles, laughter. Why are they targeting doctors? Why are they targeting journalists? It does not make sense. We have Dr. Musa Khafaja. He's an OBGYN at Nasser Medical Complex. We have all of these physicians, all beautiful physicians. Dr. Hammam Al-Loh, nephrology at Shifa. Dr. Muhammad Dabur, right next to him on the right here. He was an oncopathologist. Dr. Rafat Lubbad, he was an internist at Shifa Hospital. We have here Dr. Adnan Al-Bursh. He was made famous after his martyrdom. And he was brutally tortured in Bir Sabah and Bir Sheba, in that detention center. And to his right, Dr. Omar Farwana, OBGYN, and the Dean of Medicine at the Islamic University of Gaza. These are names and faces and pictures that we should know. These are real-time heroes, not the heroes that we listen to in stories or read about fictional characters. These are our heroes, and they should be remembered as such. So, you know, there are, in light and plight of all of this injustice, we find comfort in what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us in the Holy Quran. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَلَا تَحْسَبَنَّ اللَّهَ غَافِلًا عَمَّا يَعْمَلُ الظَّالِمُونَ إِنَّمَا يُؤَخِّرُهُمْ لِيَوْمٍ تَشْخَصُ فِيهِ الْأَبْصَارِ. Never think that Allah is unaware of what the wrongdoers do. He only delays them for a day when eyes will stare, i.e. the day of judgment. And this in itself is what keeps the people of Gaza patient. This is what gives them some kind of moral support, knowing that these oppressors and wrongdoers will come to their day. Otherwise, if they did not have this Islam, if they did not have this faith in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because obviously faith in the International Committee, faith in the United Nations, faith in the United Assembly of the World or Assembly of Nations is all gone. If they did not have this faith in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and by their testimony, half of them would have committed suicide by now. They are in depression. There is nothing to live for except for the promises of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I came across this saying by Desmond Tutu, an archbishop, where he said, if you are neutral in situations of injustice, you have chosen the side of the oppressor. And I feel that this resonates so well in this issue. There is no gray zone. This is black or white, like the kufiya that some of you are wearing. This is black or white. You either are with the side of justice or not. There is no in between. And so, we always...
So I just wanted to share one of my medical students. This is a beautiful Hafiz medical student. He actually shared this with me. He's very frustrated one day and he said this. I'm going to read it off. The Arab Muslim Ummah has broken our hearts. You betrayed us when we needed you most. Instead of standing with us, you stood against us. Helping the occupation with your silence, your weapons, your cowardice, you turned your backs on Palestine. We will never forgive you. Never. You will be our opponents before Allah on the day we're here dying of hunger, our children crying themselves to sleep with empty stomachs, and you couldn't even give a single dollar to help. Not even that. One day we'll all stand before God, Allah, and you will have to answer for this, for the deep betrayal you've shown, not just to Gaza, but to yourselves, to your faith, and to humanity, the world too. Every last one of you who watched us suffer and chose to do nothing.
It's profoundly scary what he just said. That they will be our opponents, or we will be their opponents on the day of judgment. They have reached out constantly to the world, and the world has reached out, has consistently turned their back against them. Something as simple as food, aid, feeding starving children, where only a few kilometers away people are eating to their fill. This should not be happening in 2025. This should not be happening when you have civilization and humanitarianism and the Muslim Ummah at large, who are the first people who should come together and help these people and help our brothers and sisters? And so the question that we always get, and I don't know if anybody here has prayed at Mosque Foundation today, but in the lecture, we were actually told this as well. If you're still asking, what can I do, what can I do, you're not thinking enough about this. You should have sat down by yourself already and already sat down, thought what I can do, and started pushing for it. However, we are here to remind you and we are here to give you ideas. Now, there are certain tiers of help that you can do. You can help on the personal level, help yourself. You can help on the community level, and you can help on the ummah or world at large. Now, on the personal level, this should have changed you. This should have made you more human conscious. This should have made you more aware of our surroundings, more aware of who, of the devastation and catastrophes of the world around you. You should have become a better person. You should have become a better Muslim. I'm speaking to non-Muslims and to Muslims at the same time. This is a test of resilience, not just for the Gazans, but for yourselves as well. It is up to each and every one of us to better their mannerisms, to better their character, and to be a better person. So that's on the personal level. On the community level, it is your job and your responsibility to educate those around you. You should be educating your family. You should be educating your aunts and uncles at those cookouts and get-togethers where they say, oh, the conflict is complicated. Oh, I don't want to talk about that. It's too complicated. No, you should be there. You should be the one fighting on behalf of those who are oppressed in Gaza. You should be the one voicing their opinions for the voiceless. In those who work in environments where ideas and opinions are very heavily biased, you should be the one to tell your colleagues what is going on. Dr. Aziz has had extensive conversations with everyone around him. And, you know, he can share more about that. But people did not know about this. People did not know about his testimonies or the testimonies of the Gazans until they heard it from him directly. And, what were their perspectives on this?
I mean, people are saying, one of my nurse practitioners I work with in Wisconsin, she said, I went home to my husband and kids and talked about what you said at work about your experience in Gaza, and we did a media search, and nowhere in mainstream does it match up with what you're saying, mainstream media. She's obviously referring to Fox News and the likes. And, you know, I made it a... My principle is I'm not going to give my sources onto someone else, and I told her, it's your journey to find the truth, and I trust you to find the truth through the sources that are available to you. And that actually pushed her to look more. And now she texted me again today asking about that specific journalist that was bombed in the burn unit. And she's like, even if that was a resistance agent, how could that possibly have gone unaccounted for? So what I'm trying to say is the more we talk about this, the more people are waking up. And you and I are not going to save the Gazans individually. Our goal is to just talk to the small circles that we have. If you have a big circle, that's great. Use that, right? If you have a big social media following, great. Use it. Everyone has to do something. Even if your circle's one person, that's fine. Convince that one person what justice really is.
And it's working. The tide is shifting. People are waking up. People are opening their eyes. People are understanding what Palestine is and what the plight of the Palestinians are, and it's truly a turning point in recent history.
And coming back from Gaza, I will say it has motivated me at a different level. I've never been motivated before, and I'm saying be creative in how you bring this up. You're at the supermarket, you're checking out. Just open up some small talk with the intention of bringing up Gaza. You know. Just say, how's your day? And then, do you know what's going on overseas? Talk about it a little bit. Yesterday, on my way back from work, I got one of those spam calls, someone from Vermont. And so, this was like an old grandpa. So I was like, well, that's kind of weird that an old grandpa called me. And he got mad. He's like, what are you calling me for? And I was like, I don't know, you called me. And so then I started talking to him, and I was like, what are you doing? And he's like, I'm eating supper. It's like 5 o'clock. And I was like, what are you eating? Pasta. And I was like, all right. Do you believe in God? He's like, yes, I do. I was like, do you know what's going on in Gaza? He's like, yeah. He said his energy just like dropped. And I was like, please pray for them. And we hung up. And that's what I'm saying. Just like, I don't know if that guy's real or that affected him in any way, but I did my part, you know? So that's what I'm saying. Like, do your part. Find out creative ways where you can talk to people. Even if you're not social, well, make yourself social. It doesn't matter. This is so important, what's going on right now.
This is so beyond you and me. This is so beyond our lives. Our lives, you know, these people are starving. They're being killed. This onslaught. Our lives should truly be on hold right now in supporting their lives. We are their voice. We are their resilience where they cannot be resilient on their own. And truly standing up and talking and fighting the propaganda is resilience.
On a community level, I still can't believe I'm going to Muslim-owned businesses or even Palestinian-owned businesses and they're selling Coca-Cola. Like, what is going on? That's such a basic BDS concept that we should have already implemented years ago. And it frustrates me, but this is part of our project. We should, you know, in a respectful manner, educate people on what we can avoid buying.
Economic sanctions and boycotts and divestments are extremely powerful, and you can see how, you know, how crazed these big companies and these pharma and these millionaires and billionaires are getting once you mention boycott and divestments. Francesca Albanese, the UN special rapporteur, she called for the boycotts of certain companies that were aiding in the genocide, and automatically she got sanctioned. You can tell how important boycotting is. No, let no one tell you that what's one person gonna do? What's one person boycotting these huge companies gonna do? We saw what happened to Starbucks. Their shares have gone way down. These big companies are coming to their knees just over their stances with the oppressors. And so, finally, what you can do to Gaza itself. Again, personal, community, and worldwide. Personal, there should not go a day, there should not go a prayer where you are not making dua for them, where you are not praying for them. You should be praying for them every single prayer. You should be praying for them at every single opportunity. We should be making qiyam al-layl, or praying at night when everybody is asleep, is one of the most powerful tools in a Muslim's arsenal. This is something that we should be doing every single day. It doesn't have to be overboard. You don't have to pray 10 rak'ahs. It can be just 2. And make the sincere dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala at night. On a community level, we can come together. We can fundraise. We can donate. We can crowdsource. And we can help these people as much as we can. And then finally, some special opportunities. Doctors, please make the effort to go. You don't have to be a trauma surgeon. You can be anybody. You can be a pathologist. There are no pathologists in Nasser Hospital. They need pathologists to read slides. God has given you this blessing of being a physician. You should make the effort of going. Especially US physicians, we have this ability to go, and we have this ability to enter. And then something dear to Aziz's heart, Aqsa.
So we're going to transition a little bit to Saadia here, but shortly. But I just wanted to Surah Al-Imran, the last ayah. A'udhu billahi min shaitan rajim, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ya ayyuhal ladhina aminu sbiru wa sabiru wa rabitu wattaqullah la'allakum tuflihun. So this means, O believers, patiently endure, persevere, stand on guard, and be mindful of Allah so that you may be successful. So the word I want to identify here is wa rabitu. So I would say in Palestine, Gaza, everyone knows this, you know, this ayah, this verse, at the back, like the back of their hand. We in America don't. Being on ribat literally means just being steadfast, standing your ground. It doesn't mean, you know, offensive or defensive. It just means standing your ground, like the women are doing in Gaza. Like, they are literally sitting in their tents with their children trying to survive till the next day. That's ribat. That is just existing. And so in our a tradition, we are taught that Ascalon, which is historic Gaza, is the best place for Reebok in the world. And that is what the women and elderly and the men and the children are doing in Gaza. You might ask, why don't they just leave and survive another day? Because they are following this tenet, which they wholeheartedly believe in and experience, that this is their Reebok. The reality is most of us are not going to be able to take part in that Reebok. So I thought about this a lot. What is the second best Reebok in the world that you can actually join as an American citizen? Is going to Masjid Al-Aqsa. And alhamdulillah, I was given the opportunity to go there in Ramadan. And the stories are very similar to the stories in Gaza, except there's not mass killing, but it is mass oppression. And oppression on every level. And the people there, when you actually talk to them, they all say two things. Number one, why is this masjid so empty? This is your masjid too. Why aren't you coming to visit it? And then the second one is, we don't have a voice, so please come back, go back to America and share our stories. And actually, Sister Sadia was supposed to do a talk about her Aqsa experience at this event, but then when she found out I came back from Gaza, she sacrificed that opportunity and she wanted us to talk about Gaza. So I appreciate that. But with that, I'd like to hand over the mic and she's going to talk a little bit about Masjid Al-Aqsa.
Thank you, everyone.
Can we give it up for Aziz and Hassan? Takbir. 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 Sorry, guys. All right. So they already went through some of the calls to action. Sorry, this is really small, but you will get it in a follow-up email, so make sure that we have your email address. But before we get into the calls to action, I want to take a moment to, again, acknowledge the people that made tonight happen. Believe it or not, but tonight was made possible by a group of artists. And I want to acknowledge the artists of our community. The artists who bring community together, who hold our culture, who create beautiful paintings like this to remember this horrific moment in history, to never forget what we've witnessed, and to encapsulate that. So, Jeanette, I want to thank you so much for everything from Al-Hub, Thaer from Al-Hub as well, Caleb with Al-Hub too. Also, Rania with USPCN, thank you so much, one of our critical organizers. And Abid as well with Al-Hub. Yeah. So many other people that I'm not mentioning by name. I also, again, want to express gratitude to Al-Bawadi for opening this up, fully sponsoring us tonight. Please support Al-Bawadi. Please buy from them. Please tip the waiters. I also want to acknowledge AMP, American Muslims for Palestine. Healthcare workers, Chicago healthcare workers for Palestine, who are going to talk about a very important campaign that I need everyone to participate in next week particularly, so we'll call them up in a second. But the Palestinian Youth Movement, PYM, will be coming and sharing with another call to action with us in a second, and AMC Civic Coalition, and I think that's all. And Tethered is the organization that led the Lamseb al-Aqsa delegation that Aziz mentioned. You can follow us on Tethered. It's with Tethered with three T's on Instagram. And I'm just going to start with the first call to action, which is never stop talking about Gaza, especially to neutral colleagues. They already did a great job speaking about that, but creatively sparking those conversations. The second one, I'm going to ask Rania to come up and share about getting involved locally. And if Hiba can be on deck to share, as well as Aaron, if you can be on deck.
Hi, everyone. Firstly, thank you, Hassan and Aziz, for the amazing presentation. I definitely recommend that you guys do more of these. Report backs, because it's really important, and the content that you guys shared was something that everyone should hear, truly. So hi, everyone. Of course, a couple of things. You know, I'm speaking to a room filled with people who always come out to actions, events, etc., etc. So I just want to remind you again that, you know, the Chicago Coalition for Justice in Palestine has mass mobilized protests every single week, right? There's going to be one tomorrow at 3:30 off of Wacker in Michigan. If you can't make it out tomorrow, you can make it out to the next one, because we have one at least every single week, and it's extremely important that we show up to these protests, right? And mass mobilized actions is only one tool and one form of organizing, right? They allow for everyone within the community to participate in them. So I think it's really important. It's one of the bare minimum things that we can do and be a part of, and, you know, to fight for Palestine, right? So that's number one. Number two, I think it's really important that we are calling and emailing and holding our elected representatives accountable. I know there's a lot of people in this room who probably live in the southwest suburbs, and as you all know, your representative is Sean Kasten, as one of them, who is someone who champions himself on progressive politics, but he is not a progressive because he does not believe in the liberation of Palestine, right? And Sean Kasten represents one of the largest Palestinian communities in the country. So that's number one. And so if you want to get involved in something more confrontational than mass mobilized protests, of course, the movement would love to have you. So you can always come talk to me if you want to get involved into actions that are other than the weekly protests, because we would love for everyone to be a part of those, right? Especially constituents of the elected representatives that we are targeting, for example. And another final thing that I want to mention, hold on, my memory is really bad. Oh, yes, okay. So us in the state of Illinois, the Illinois state treasurer is Michael Frerichs, right? And I just want to let you know a little bit about Michael Frerichs. We have a campaign that's targeting him because he is responsible for Illinois being the leading state in the United States that has the most investments in Israeli bonds. We have $120 million that are invested in Israel, right? That's ridiculous. So we are constantly targeting him. And so I call on all of you, right, to, if you are a part of an organization and your organization has not signed on to the campaign, right, there's a petition online happening and you haven't signed on, please go back to your organizations and think about signing on. But if you are just a member and you, you know, are just like a member from within the community, I call on you to join an organization, right? There are many organizations that exist, you know, organizations like USPCN, for example, or AMP, or Al Hub, or PYM, right? And so find the organization that you feel like you can join and be a part of. And if you are not Arab, right, there's so many other organizations as well, like Anti-War Coalition, the Chicago Alliance Against Racism and Political Repression. There are other organizations that you can be a part of and join the movement, because at the end of the day, we need to do something, right? Whether it's fighting for Palestine, whether it's fighting against the Trump administration, we cannot sit idly by. And everyone has something to bring to the movement. Everybody does, right? You all have a skill. So your presence matters. And I call on all of you to show up to things that you see, follow the different organizations on social media, show up, tell your friends, tell your family, because we need to show up. We don't have an option anymore to keep going, because at the end of the day, change doesn't just happen. We have to make it happen. We have to fight for liberation, right? So I'm calling on all of you, please join. It's never too late. The movement is here. Thank you.
Hiba or Aaron, whoever. Yeah, Hiba, we're ready for you.
And you will get all these action items as a follow-up email as well, and links and all that.
Hi, everyone. I'm not prepared for this, so sorry if it's all over the place, but it's okay. I just want to echo a couple of things that have kind of already been said, but, you know, just the importance of showing up for your community, showing up to these action events, to these protests. We often get the question, you know, what's the point of coming to the protest? They're not listening. We've been protesting for 2 years. Nothing's changing. It is not up to you to decide whether it's the right thing to do. We should do it. Palestinians in Gaza are asking us to take to the streets. It is our duty here in the diaspora to take to the streets if that's what they want. There, we sometimes will be working on one thing for months, even years at a time before we see any change. I wanna, you know, plug in something from the PYM. Last year, we started the MERS campaign. We exposed MERS, a logistics company, for their role in facilitating the genocide. A whole year of people working on these reports, doing research in their free time. And just recently, just a few weeks ago, Maersk announced, after a report was released detailing their role in this genocide, announced that they are divesting from all illegal Israeli settlements. They're no longer doing business there. It took, yes. It took a year of dozens of people across the nation, youth across the nation, doing this research for us to see something come out of it. So just like our brother said, your job is to do, your job is to show up. It is God's job to make it happen. So I just want to encourage everybody to keep showing up to protest, to keep showing up to events like these. Emphasize also the power of storytelling. Amplify the voices of Palestinians. That was their main request from us in Palestine, was to amplify their voices. That is our duty here in the diaspora. And then one more thing that I want to plug in. So actually last year, the MERS campaign first came out of the People's Conference for Palestine. That was the first conference that we had, the People's Conference for Palestine, last year in Detroit. That is where the MERS campaign first was born. And this year, the People's Conference for Palestine is August 29th through the 31st in Detroit. Last year, we had thousands of people from all across the country show up for this conference. This is a golden opportunity to meet people from all across the nation, thousands of people from across the nation, all fighting for one cause, coming together under one roof. So it is such an important event for people to show up to connect, and hopefully to plan more things like the MERS campaign. So I hope to see you all in Detroit in August, and I hope to see you all around our community, inshallah. Thank you.
And there's currently a registration code for a discount for that conference, so we'll send that in the follow-up email.
Follow PYM Chicago.
Follow PYM Chicago. Aaron, with the Healthcare Workers for Palestine. This is a really important campaign, so I need everybody to listen up.
Okay, thank you, everybody. My name is Aaron, and I'm a community health nurse here in Chicago. And I'm an organizer with Healthcare Workers for Palestine. I started passing these flyers out, but I have more. I have some in Arabic and in English. The largest drug manufacturer of generic drugs in the world is based in Israel, and it's called Teva Manufacturing. If you haven't heard of this company, they make billions of dollars every year, and they are profiting from the genocide in Palestine. And there's things that you can do very quickly and easily. One is that you can call your pharmacy and you can tell them that you don't want medications from Teva. Safety warning, if there's no alternatives, please don't stop your medication. But often there are alternatives. There are other manufacturers that make a lot of these generic medications, so you can try to find an alternative. It's very easy to do. A lot of people have had success, and the more pharmacies that we talk to, the more people we talk to, the bigger this campaign will be. It's already an international campaign. There's a lot of states that are involved here in the U.S., also in Europe and in South Africa as well. So we want people to participate in that level. We're also going to be doing a flyering action next week. There's a group here in Bridgeview that's going to be going to pharmacies, trying to talk to pharmacists, also trying to talk to people standing in line just to tell them that this is a really important campaign. Teva is a horrible company on multiple levels. They also helped to push the opioid epidemic here in this country. They've been charged with price fixing, corruption, so multiple levels that you can talk to people about this campaign. I will pass these flyers out, but we really want to try to expand this boycott and do what we can to get rid of the billions of dollars this company is making off of genocide in Palestine. So,
can you just mention how you, what's your generic, like how do you go into a pharmacy and convince them that this is, needs to be boycotted?
Sure. So there's a script in here, but one of the things you can do is you can just go in or you can call the pharmacy. And you can say, you know, I take these medications. I want to know if it's made by Teva. You can look at the bottle, and at the bottom it has to say the manufacturer, so you can know. You can say the next time I get a refill, I would prefer to not have Teva if there's any alternatives, and they can actually put it in your chart. And if any of you are pharmacists or prescribers, you can try to also find more information on your end of how you can talk to your patients about the fact that you don't want to prescribe Teva if there's any alternative. Yeah. Any other questions before? Oh, yeah. We, right now we're really in the early stages of trying to figure out what we need to do, but there's different aspects of the campaign we want to get involved in. So we're open to all kinds of suggestions of things that we can do, but it's true. Yeah, Walgreens is based here, so. I'll pass more of these out if you want more information. You can also talk to me afterwards.
Thank you. And I think just before we get into the Q&A, we had some phenomenal questions, so just stick around for that. We'll get to get more intimate and you know, just authentic with the physicians in a second. I just wanted to share the last call to action.
Do you want to share about the programs? We'll send it as a follow-up.
Yeah, just if any healthcare workers are interested in going to Gaza that are able to go, please speak directly with Aziz and Hassan about the few organizations that they're connected to who can send people. So that's a direct conversation with Aziz and Hassan if the healthcare workers are interested in going on an upcoming delegation to Gaza. If you're interested in going on an upcoming delegation to the other parts of occupied Palestine, there are organizations that facilitate that as well. I'm happy to field some of those questions too. And, you know, we also in a follow-up email, you'll get information about the report back we were going to do about that campaign in particular. So attend that when it happens. And we have some youth in our community that will be embarking very shortly on a delegation to Palestine. So whenever they come back and have their report back, be sure to look out for that and support them in listening to the stories that they bear witness to as well. So on that note, we're going to go to the Q&A. And Aziz is going to...
I just wanted to comment on sacrifice, and we're all talking about. We're all talking about, you know, what we can do. I just wanted to share a story of the Canadian doctor. Okay, I'm not going to say his name, but he's in Gaza right now, and him and his wife have three kids or four kids living in Canada. He makes a very good salary in Canada, and he basically said he's going to go to Gaza and never come back until he either dies there or the genocide's over. And he left his wife and four kids in Canada with their permission, and that's the sacrifice he made, and he's not going to give that up. So what I'm trying to say is we all have to step up. We got to do something. We got to go to these protests. We got to go to these picket, you know, we got to go to these pharmacies. We got to do everything we can
to sacrifice whatever it is that we can. Not everyone's asking for that level of sacrifice, but people are making that level of sacrifice, which is impressive.
You want to introduce me?
Assalamu alaikum. So this is a special opportunity. Yezen is actually from Gaza, and he recently came here from a medical aspect, and alhamdulillah, we're honored to meet you. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. And we'd like to give you the mic, okay?
السلام عليكم انا يزن من غزة اجيت هين للعلاج وشكرا لانكم اجيتوا
سلام I'm Yezen I came here to receive medical attention and care and it's an honor to come and see you all and meet you all He's 16 years old.
بدك تحكي بالمايك ولا عادي؟
عادي
احكي بالمايك اللي بالعربي خلص بسمع بالعربي وانا بدك
أنا الناجي الوحيد من بين 8 أشخاص أولاد عمي ومن بينهم أخوي.
He's the lone survivor of his family, of his cousins, of his it's only him and his brother right now, his sister. Sorry, he's the lone survivor, but he's happy to be here and he's happy to see you all.
Say thank you from on behalf of us for being so strong and showing us what resilience is.
So we're going to tell him thank you on behalf of everyone here for his resilience and for his strength. شكرا يا يزن على وجودك هون وشكرا على على صمودك ورباطك وقوتك والله انك مفخره و احنا كلنا فخورين فيك. All right. Round of applause for Yezen. Sadia, should we start with the Q&A?
Assalamu alaikum all. Thank you, doctors. Inshallah, we will be able to get through all the questions, but these are really great questions, and we'll do as many as we can. The first question. How often are children arriving unidentified with no parents or family with them?
This is a painful question. It's very often, I want to say. It's almost every day. It's children that are unidentified. It's adults that are unidentified. And when they come in, as majhul. That's the name that they're given in the triage bay, which means unknown. And they wait. They wait until a family member comes and claims them. And sometimes family members never show up. Either they're under rubble or they've been martyred themselves. So I would say it's a common occurrence, and we've seen unidentified children.
While you were there, was there any type of pain relief of any sort?
So in the ER, they were using ketamine for just knocking the patients out. And surprisingly, it worked really well. It's not the standard go-to medication here in America, but it did work pretty well. We were able to put chest tubes, emergency drains in without them, you know, screaming in pain. The anesthesiology team surprisingly did have medications to perform surgeries, and very rarely were we in circumstances where we were actually doing procedures without anesthesia. Now, this is a huge caveat. All the resources in Gaza are going to Nasser Hospital where we were working. So it's actually, that answer is not very accurate. The answer should be, the question should be more like, of what percent of hospitals in Gaza are providing anesthesia services, right? So Nasser Hospital is probably a high percent. If you go to Shifa Hospital or Indonesian Hospital or Ridwan Hospital up north, I don't know the numbers, but I guarantee the full spectrum of anesthesia pain medications are not getting there. So again, most of the resources were directed to Nasser Hospital in Gaza because that really is the last tertiary care academic center with pretty much all specialties. And not to say it's working 100%. Everyone's just trying to make it work.
Can you talk about the smell in Gaza, the things that we cannot perceive nor see on social media? What did Gaza smell like?
Wow. That's a good question.
It's an interesting question. I want to hear your thoughts first.
SubhanAllah. That's a very awesome question. First of all, the sights. The sunsets were the most beautiful sunsets we've ever seen. The sky lights up orange and red in colors that can't describe, and the ocean in the background, the Mediterranean, to the sand. We would pick up the sand and let it sift through our fingers and know that how many people have sacrificed their lives on the sand. And that's the visuals. The smell was clean. It's aside from the bombs, you know, in 5 minutes after the bombs, you would smell the thermite. But aside from that, it was a very clean, fresh smell, which makes no sense. The people don't have showers there. They don't have soap there. You know, it doesn't make sense. The ER should smell like absolute horrors, but it doesn't, you know. And I think people take care of themselves. And outside, it's just this beautiful breeze. Because, again, it's an oceanside. Gaza's oceanside, so you're getting this constant light breeze. The weather's nice, it's temperate. And then the sounds, you know, aside from the wails that I described when people are identifying their loved ones, it's just this gentle background noise of people chit-chatting, catching up with their families aside their patient beds. Just a normal life that they're trying to live. It's really not what the media is describing. It's just normalcy amongst this craziness. I don't really know how to describe it. It's such a paradox. You're in this hospital where nothing makes sense, where kids are blown up into pieces and trying to heal, yet everyone's laughing and smiling and just trying to be normal.
I would say, everything that Aziz had said, some other sounds that I heard a lot was laughter. We would hear laughter a lot. In the resident workrooms and the doctor workrooms, when we would go outside and see kids playing, there were kids playing. And you could hear them laugh, and I think that was truly beautiful. But obviously it's not a perfect picture. There's the cup half empty and glass half full. You would hear the wailing. You would hear the crying. You would smell, especially in the trauma bay, when there was a massive MCI. You would feel like you were, and forgive me for this picture, like in a slaughterhouse. There was blood everywhere. There was the smell of iron from the blood. It was very, very hot in those rooms. And so in this beautiful land and constantly sucked back into this reality. Once you leave that, I don't know how people do it. I don't know how the Gazans do it, but it's like a switch where they're in the middle of this chaos. And we've seen the ER doctors. They're suddenly so into focus. We're saving this person's life. We're intubating them. You know, we're resuscitating them. And then, khalas, when they can't take it anymore after an hour or 2 hours, they go, they take a breather in the call room. They sit down together, they're drinking a cup of tea, and they're laughing. Because if they weren't able to do that, they would have broken down a long time ago. And so, again, they want to live life. They live life. They enjoy life. And all that you know about living, they do it. They do it. I think that was a beautiful question. So thank you forever. Asked that, and whoever wanted to feel what the Gazans and Palestinians feel at a personal level. Thank you.
How would you describe the mental health of those in Gaza? And while we know they remain steadfast and resilient, and they're living life the best they could, how is their mental health?
Yeah, I hope we don't end on this question, because this is a real question. I will say 100% of Gaza society is clinically depressed, but they're not taking any medications. I will say probably reaching 100% that everyone has considered suicide. They will not commit that because they're deeply religious people and it's against their religion to commit suicide. But everyone has thought it. To the point, many have almost convinced themselves to go to the GHF sites just so they can get shot and die. And this is the reality that one ER nurse that I keep in touch with who has a 3-month-old at home, he said, when my 3-month-old and my wife die, I'm going to the GHF sites and I hope to die a shaheed. That's his plan. Because committing suicide is wrong. But if you get shot, plus, life's over, right? To the point, we had a medical student with us. She's 22 years old. We're doing rounds, kind of like sitting in a circular table. Everyone's kind of talking about patients. She stops us, and she says, what happens to the body after death? And so we kind of gave some random answers here and there. We didn't really know where this was going. And then she stops us again and says, my uncle and 20 family members just got drone striked 1 hour ago. I'm a doctor. I don't know how to respond to this. Just kind of stay silent for the next few minutes. Her no crying, no facial expression, just completely blank. And that's the reality. That's not just her. Every single person in Gaza has a story. And it's not just once. It's weekly that they have family members dying, with their cousin, a brother, uncle. And the reality is, behind that smile that they will initially give you, and always give you if they just see you as an outsider, the moment you put your hand on their shoulder, you realize that smile just quickly fades away and you see the pain that they're hiding. And they don't, this is the sad part, they don't talk to each other about their pain, because everyone is going through the same thing. So why would I vent to my friend or my family member? They don't have any room in their mental capacity to listen to what you have to say. And that's unfortunately where we come in. And I say unfortunately because it's heavy. I wake up now at Fajr, and the first thing I see on my phone is my cousin died. I have no food today. I'm going to the GHF site. Pray for me. And they have no one else to say this, but they feel comfortable saying this to me, right? So I'm going to keep it going, but it's heavy.
I was rounding with one of my attendings one day, and he gets a call in the middle of rounds. And he says, what? Are you sure? And he hangs up the phone and he says, my nephew just died. He's a 30-year-old man. He went to the aid sites. He got shot. And he says, I need to go. Please do the rest of rounds. And I said, of course, go. And he goes. The next day when we round, he's there. He's there right in there in the morning at 8 a.m. ready to round, and he's smiling and laughing. These people have found a way to suppress their pain so efficiently that they don't feel it anymore, that they've essentially found a way to numb themselves without medication. But like Aziz said, if you sit down with them, if a therapist or a psychiatrist or psychologist sits down with them, you will uncover years psychological trauma that would need years to fix. Echoing what Aziz said about rather going to the aid sites to and be killed than as a source, as a way to substitute suicide, more than one person has told me, I would rather be killed than shot and be paralyzed. I do not want to be paralyzed. I do not want to be a burden on my family. I do not want my family dragging me around. I would rather just be dead. It was much easier for families to say goodbye to their loved ones in the ER if they had just come and been shot and be dead on arrival. They would say, well, that's it. To God we belong, and to God we return. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Pick them up, take them to the morgue. It was that simple for them, because that's the only way they can survive right now.
How are you able to go into Gaza as a doctor? Israel allows this? As being Americans, as being American doctors, how are you able to go to Gaza?
So, doctors are allowed to go. There are campaigns that, you know, organizations that facilitate the entry of doctors. Our facility is called Rahma Worldwide. It's a humanitarian organization that sends delegations all around the world, and they had invited us to this delegation to Gaza. I do think us being Americans was a huge plus, but there were also other nationalities along with our delegation. There was a Jordanian, and there was a French Algerian as well. There was a British Egyptian, and there were more than one nationality. We also saw other organizations there like MAP, Medical Aid for Palestine, PANSMA, an Australian agency, and there were doctors from around the world. We saw Spanish doctors, Norwegian doctors, we saw all kinds of nationalities, and truly it shows that the whole world is united for Palestine, and the whole world is united for Gaza, and they will do whatever they can to go in. I will say that Israel doesn't allow everyone in, and a big chunk of our delegation was actually denied access only 12 hours before going. But thankfully, for some reason or another, they allowed us. And we actually asked Allah, we asked God to allow us to enter and to prevent this from prevent us from being denied.
This is from one of our younger ones in the audience. As a child, how can we be helpful to Gaza? As a child, how can we be helpful to Gaza? With a big question mark.
And we're going to close on that note, which I think is a beautiful note to close on. Just so you all know, Bouadi is closing in a few minutes. If you wanted to get a meal to go on your way out, please make that order. Just wanted to say that, and this will be the last question.
I think that's a beautiful question for our youth. I see my kids. I have a 9-year-old, 6-year-old, and they're super into this whole, how can we support Palestine, BDS. The other day, we bought some chocolate chip cookies from Costco, brought it home, plopped it on the counter, and my daughter comes up to me and be like, Baba, this is Nestle. I go, what's going to go return it, right? So it's like these kids are beautiful, man. Like, you guys are doing your part. You know, you guys are going to be the next generation, and you guys are going to be way better than us. We're learning. I mean, I just learned about TIVA. Like, you guys are going to know about that when you're 9, 10 years old, you know. So let's keep this going. The kids are the future. We teach them through actions, but through knowledge. And I'm really happy about that question.
You know, just asking that question makes us super proud. The whole idea was for the older generation to die off and the newer generation to forget. That's kind of the way that they had envisioned this process to happen. Well, I mean, you know, 1948 has passed. 1967 has passed. The multiple wars against Gaza throughout the last 20, 25 years have passed. And we're still having 9-year-olds, 8-year-olds ask, how can me as a child help Palestine and Gaza? This is a nightmare. This is a nightmare for their propagandists. They're completely failing if we have children asking this question. So just asking that, you're doing more than enough. Thank you.
I really appreciate all of you guys coming and taking your time to give us your ears. We have so many stories, and you giving us this opportunity to share these stories is very therapeutic for us. But at the end of the day, it's really about sharing the stories of these beautiful human beings in Gaza who have zero voice, and even social media doesn't really do it justice. Their beautiful smiles and their beautiful hospitality is something I cannot forget. Despite the pain that they showed us, that we saw firsthand, the one thing that sticks out to me more than anything is there's just smiles. Always happy that we're there. We had patients' fathers. The patient just died. The father turns around and says, thank you guys so much for coming here, giving up what you have back home and spending time with us. Honestly, these guys are so grateful for everything, and especially us. You know, when we speak up for them, they are legitimately happy. In Aqsa, one of the youth who was in college in occupied Palestine asked me, have you ever been to any of the protests on the college campuses? He was so excited to ask me that question. And luckily I had been, and I honestly responded in the affirmative that I had been to those college protests. And I'm telling you, they love when we speak up for them. They really do.
Thank you, everyone, for coming tonight. Thank you for coming out. Thank you for listening to their voices. Thank you for hearing their stories. What you're doing now today, what you're doing is keeping the resilience up and fighting. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you all so much. I'm just going to end on affirming and acknowledging that our victory is closer than we can ever imagine, that our victory is coming, and we know that is the truth. And from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, inshallah. I mean, good night, everybody. Oh, and we're going to pray Isha, the night prayer, before we leave, so feel free to do that. And then that just has one more thing.
So if you'd like to continue supporting Palestinian youth in this neighborhood, we recently just opened up the Jerusalem Academy of the Arts, the first art studio museum space in the southwest suburbs, and directly correlated with and organized with Gaza and Ramallah. So we are very nearby, about a block away. Please come by whenever, and if you guys have any ideas on how we can take care of our children more, we are very much open to it, because this is a space made for the kids, by the kids. Thank you.